We always used to say that people want to talk more about zucchini than they do about zoning. It was a way of letting them see that choices about land development really resonate at their table, very personally.
You're listening to the Good Dirt Podcast. This is a place where we dig into the nitty-gritty of sustainable living through food, fashion, and lifestyle.
And we're your hosts, Mary and Emma Kingsley, the mother and daughter founder team of Lady Farmer. We're sowing seeds of slow living through our community platform, events, and online marketplace.
We started this podcast as a means to share the wealth of information and quality conversations that we're having in our world as we dream up and deliver ways for each of us to live into the new paradigm, one that is regenerative, balanced, and whole.
We want to put the microphone in front of the voices that need to be heard the most right now. The farmers, the dreamers, the designers, and the doers.
So come cultivate a better world with us. We're so glad you're here. Now, let's dig in.
So this morning, I came to Locals Restaurant, which is the local coffee shop, which is called Locals, where I come to record often when the internet at the farm is not behaving, which is lately been like all the time. So I walk in and I order my coffee like I always do. And Sandy Wright, one of the co-owners, said, "Oh, no charge. Another customer has come in and bought a cup of coffee for you and other people in the spirit of pay it forward." So I thought that was really wonderful. It was so delightful. It was such a delight to get a free cup of coffee and from a person I've never met. It just emphasized for me the real delight in this place, this community place. They have homegrown food. It's owned and run by a married couple that just live a couple of miles down the road. And they've really put their heart and soul into this business to just celebrate local food, celebrate local people, celebrate community. It's such a gift. And I'm so, so grateful to them for letting me come here to record. It's another gracious gesture to the community and everything that goes on here.
Yay, Locals. That pay it forward idea is so sweet too. I've seen that sometimes on people do that in the drive-through, or people will leave a really big tip at a restaurant. It can be life-changing sometimes, you know? Like maybe the person behind you is having a really bad day, or it's just a surprise, that unexpected fun thing. So maybe if you're listening to this today and feel inspired, maybe you could pay it forward somehow.
Yeah, I think the surprise element of it is just so uplifting, you know, like you're going through your day, you just do all the normal things, things become automatic. And then suddenly, hey, someone has done this favor for you, someone you don't even know. Mm-hmm. It's really fun. It's really something that helps us out in this time of craziness and bad news and bad feelings a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's just a way of making things a little bit better. Just right where
Definitely.
You are.
Well, do you want to hear what's up with me today?
I do, indeed.
My air conditioning is broken.
Oh, gosh, I'm sorry. It's been so hot.
Yes, that's a thing. I will tell you, though, having your air conditioning broken is a good way to slow you down.
Yeah, it's so interesting you should bring that up, because I was just thinking this morning, actually, about how when I grew up without air conditioning. I don't want this to be one of those, well, when I was growing up, things were a lot harder kind of story. But yeah, and we were hot. Yeah, you got hot and, you know, you had to sleep with the fan blowing straight on you at night, and you stayed outside way into the evening because it was too hot to be inside. But we survived.
You made it through.
We made it through. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have air conditioning or air conditioning
that. Well, no, I had that thought this morning too. Most places in the world actually don't have air conditioning. And it's been record heat this summer in Europe, and they don't have air conditioning mostly at all in Europe because they normally don't have to. And in the Northeast, even in the Northeast United States, when I lived in Boston for a while, most of the houses don't have air conditioning.
Right.
And people know how to deal with it. You close all the blinds during the day so that the sun mostly doesn't get in, which is, I was so unused to that because usually I barely even have curtains on my windows. But yeah, in the north, you usually close your blinds to keep the sun out. And then at night when you open the blinds, it's very cool because the house has been cool all day. So yeah, there's ways to deal with it.
Right. And it also brings people outside.
Right.
I was referring to, as a child, people would be outside, the kids would be playing and running around. And I remember my mom reminiscing about how when she was a child, everybody in the neighborhood, adults included, would come outside and the adults would bring their lawn chairs and just plop them in the front yard and sit there and talk until it was time to go in and go to bed. And so everybody was out. So it was like a community gathering on the hot summer evenings.
Yeah, every night. So fun.
Yeah. So we kind of lost that.
We did some of that during COVID. That's funny. During quarantine on our little street. There was much more, ironically, much more hanging out with our neighbors in a very slow and relaxed way than now.
So interesting, isn't it?
Because we were so desperate, I guess, for any kind of interaction. So yeah, a lawn chair on your front lawn talking 10 feet away from your neighbor was like the safest thing you could do.
That really is ironic.
It is.
And all the isolation, you were actually interacting with your neighbors.
Yeah. And I'm just having this thought on really beautiful nights. I want to go somewhere with a patio and get a drink or get dinner or something. But it's annoying to me that I feel like I have to go like spend money if I want to be out in the world seeing other people. But I guess I don't have to. I could just get a lawn chair, sit on my outside my stoop. I'll do that next time.
Well, speaking of that, actually, at Locals Restaurant, they're hoping to begin to be open in the evenings and to serve beer and wine and kombucha.
Mm-hmm.
They're setting up for that right now. They're trying to put that in place. So that adds another element to the local gathering place. It's not just a morning and lunch place. It's a place where you can come for the evening. So,
well, for you listening, wherever you are, first of all, I hope that you are feeling comfortable with your air temperature. And if you're not comfortable, if your AC is broken like mine is, just taking the opportunity to, understand that humans have survived a really long time without air conditioning and that being outside is usually not as uncomfortable as we've sort of been trained to. In the summer with inside when the AC is just blasting everywhere, it really messes up our temperature regulators, I feel like. So weird going inside somewhere and being cold.
Yeah, I think it conditions us and conditions our bodies to feel a certain way. And so it is jarring, you know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I hope this discussion inspires some people to take advantage of the summer warmth, shall we say.
Yeah.
And go somewhere and interact in your community.
And pay it forward.
And pay it forward and just embrace your neighborhood and embrace your region. And that really brings us right into our episode for today. Yeah.
Yeah.
Today we have Claudia Kousalas and Ellen Letourneau. And they are the co-authors of A Culinary History of Montgomery County, Maryland, which is where I live. It's right outside Washington, D.C., and where my husband and I live on a small farm. For those of you that have not met us before, this is the second book that Ellen and Claudia have co-authored, in which they've explored the food heritage of the Montgomery County Ag Reserve, which we live in, which is where our farm is located. And the first book, Bread and Beauty, A Year in Montgomery County's Agricultural Reserve, is full of beautiful photographs and wonderful recipes representing this region and this unique place that we call the Ag Reserve. You will hear all about that in the episode.
So this current book that just came out this summer, A Culinary History of Montgomery County, Maryland, there's more essays. It's more the whole county, not just the Ag Reserve. There's a few recipes in there, but it's not really a cookbook. It's really what it says it is, a culinary history. And it's fascinating because this is such a cool area being just right outside D.C. And there's so much amazing history, civil rights history and civil war history. And it really runs the gamut. And it's a really cool book.
I love how you can take food as a framework for looking at the history of a region. It's just another way of understanding it. And this is often something that can be overlooked. I mean, there's places in the world where food is a focus, like I would say like New Orleans or Paris. But in terms of where you live and these smaller places, maybe lesser known places, looking at the history of food is a way of understanding how your culture and your community has evolved over time and the people in it. And it's just another way of embracing a sense of place, of where you live and the people that you live around and the history.
So This was a fun episode because Ellen and Claudia are good friends, and we were able to record this episode in person at the farm.
Yeah.
That was really fun. So we want to be doing more in-person interviews where possible to share them with you all. And speaking of friends and paying it forward, we'd love to remind you, if you enjoy this podcast, share it with a friend. Send it to someone who might love it as much as you do. Find your favorite episode and forward it. That's a great way of paying it forward. Share the good dirt.
Yeah.
We really rely on you guys to help us grow this podcast and grow this community. And it would mean so much to us if you shared your favorite episode of The Good Dirt with a friend today.
Yes. And we thank you in advance. And wherever you are, we hope you'll enjoy this episode today. So here's Ellen Letourneau and Claudia Kousalis talking about their new book, A Culinary History of Montgomery County, Maryland.
This is Claudia Kousalis. I'm the co-author of A Culinary History of Montgomery County, Maryland, along with Ellen Letourneau. We also wrote Bread and Beauty together, and so this new book is an extension of what we did on Bread and Beauty, and we're really glad to be here with you today.
I'm Ellen Letourneau, again, co-author of Bread and Beauty and recently A Culinary History of Montgomery County. So Bread and Beauty was a project that Claudia and I got started on, and now I can never remember, 2015, I think it might have been.
Yeah.
It was a limited edition book, eventually published in 2018, and it was designed to celebrate, educate, inspire stewardship and engagement around the agricultural reserve where we are presently, and to really tell people about what goes on here, why it's here, what happens, what the intention was, how it's being used over time. And we wanted to draw people into the story from a number of different access points. So it was a cookbook. So for those who are interested in food and local food and cooking might pick it up and then learn more about the reserve because of that interest, or people who are interested in photography. We had beautiful, beautiful photography done by a local photographer, Martin Radigan, of landscapes and portraits of people who work here. We told history stories. We interviewed the people around here and what they did and how they felt about the place and the work that they do. And then we proceeded to go all over the place in the DMV, the DC, Maryland, and Virginia region, to tell a story about the reserve, because it seemed to be us that a lot of people really didn't know about it.
Yeah.
It's quite an extraordinary thing.
We always used to say that people want to talk more about zucchini than they do about zoning. It was a way of letting them see that choices about land development really resonate at their table very personally. And so, you know, politics and planning board meetings might seem very distant and unrelated to your daily life, but they're really not. And also, the other thing we always used to say is that, you know, this land looks empty or vacant when you drive through it. You know, there's nobody, the houses are spread out, there are open fields, woods, and there are even land use lawyers in the county who used to say, oh, sooner or later it'll be developed for townhouses. But we really wanted to reveal that this is not empty land, that there are people here who are making decisions and working really, really hard and providing food and recreation and spiritual retreat, protecting water and wildlife and creating jobs. And so what looks like nothing is going on is really very, very intense.
And I think the other part of it that's interesting is the proximity to the nation's capital, which is sort of keeps coming up as just, it's kind of baffling, and people in D.C. don't know that it's here, and people that live in this county don't know that it's here. So I think that's the other important part of it, and it's an interesting opportunity to highlight it and to talk about what's happening, like, right here, right in a very metropolitan area and a very active political area, obviously. Just, like, so many aspects of it to explore and to tell the story of. And the first installment of y'all's storytelling, Bread and Beauty, was a beautiful, it really was like a storybook, like with the pictures and the essays couched in a recipe cookbook.
Yeah, and I think the idea that it was put in place in 1980, and then maybe it's a static thing now, rather than something that we would hope everyone would know about, particularly who live here, but it's also a national model for farmland preservation, and quite a successful one by many measures, but also that engagement and stewardship is vital to keeping it this way. So that it's a living, breathing, important place that if we don't pay attention to it, it can so easily disappear. Yeah. And then once it disappears, you can't go backwards. It's not something you go, oops, we made a mistake. Yeah. Now we need to rip all the development out and the highways and the byways and everything that's happened to me here. It's not something you can replicate. And I think it's so highlighted then now with the pandemic and the ideas about supply chain and local food growing and climate issues and fresh water issues, all the things that it was so prescient of these people so long ago to put this in place.
Yeah. Yeah. Who said eating is a political act? I mean, the reserve is clearly an example of that. You know, these were political decisions, economic decisions to create this, and it really resonates right down to our table. And like Ellen said, and like you mentioned, a lot of people don't know what this reserve is about, what it is, how it's intended to work, how it got here. And so that was part of doing the book. We really want people to be engaged in their community. There's the politics, there's the planning board meetings, but it's also what you eat and how you spend your weekends. And it really kind of works at all levels.
To those of you that might be new listeners, we're talking about the Montgomery County Agricultural Reserve, and we have a whole episode about it, but we will link it in the show notes. It tells you all about the history, tells you how it evolved, the challenges, as Claudia and Ellen are telling us about now, the constant challenges to undo all these things that were put in place over 40 years ago now. And I think the main thing that resonates for me is that the norm is to develop. You have open land. So the normal thing is that you go in and you develop it. Townhouses, shopping centers, all sorts of places for people to do commerce.
Yeah, things for people to buy and where they're going to shop. That's interesting. That's a good point.
Our system is built on that. And so that's the natural trajectory for land.
Yeah. Land use lawyers and planners call it highest and best use.
Yeah.
That is such a judgmental statement.
Yeah.
And, you know,
according
really,
to who?
That's the best use. I hope we're seeing things differently now.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, there's also housing shortages and a housing crisis and all of that. And I think people immediately go to, but where are all these people going to live? And that's not necessarily what it is either. I think people think townhouses first, and houses is one thing, but in the world of development, I feel like townhouses are inextricably linked to strip malls or, you know, I mean, I think it's getting better now with like mixed use development is an interesting concept. And there's definitely more of that happening, but we're definitely not about like, no development, no progress, whatever. If you're lucky enough to be able to live here, then good for you and everyone else. Too bad. So sad. What is the intention? Like, what is the goals of the development? Is it to line the pockets of big box stores? You know, just kind of really asking the bigger questions.
It's what we're always talking about at Lady Farmer, is being conscious and intentional about our decisions. And that's on an individual level. And it's also on a societal level. And it's also on local level. What are people going to do with the land? I just love talking about this stuff because what you said, Claudia, a minute ago, that people drive through here and say, there's nothing going on here. This would be such a great place for XYZ. But it already is a great place for all the reasons y'all have been describing. And people tend to really ignore the fact that we need land and lots of it to grow our food. And you think, well, the food's grown in the Midwest. It's grown in California. These places are designated to grow food. Well, those places are thousands of miles away from us. As we've seen in the last couple of years, there are any number of things that can come up to disrupt the supply chains, anything from a pandemic to fuel shortages to wars abroad that affect all of these things. We hope people will start paying attention to where their food comes from, because it's not in the least bit
guaranteed
That's that right. Your grocery shelves will be fully stocked, as we're used to constantly, tomorrow
Anything can happen any day overnight, and we have seen it. That's only one of the reasons to pay attention to your local food supply. There's many others, including soil health and nutrition and climate change. I mean, there's all these things that feeds into why it's important to think about where your food comes from. Today, we're celebrating that the Montgomery County Agricultural Reserve was set aside for specific agricultural land use for growing food, and your book celebrates that in such a beautiful way. So tell us about
a culinary history of Montgomery County, Maryland.
Yeah, so we started with Bread and Beauty, and it was, you know, the cookbook, and we did a lot of research for that and couldn't include it all.
I remember you guys telling us this. We had to take this out and this
out. And there are so many great stories. And so we thought, okay, let's try another book. And our mutual friend, Tony Cohen, just down the road at Button Farm.
He's been on this podcast twice.
Yeah. And he had us over and he said, okay, what are you going to do next? And Ellen and I were like, huh. Rest, maybe, but I think he really put in our minds that there was an extension of this that we could do. And so we proposed it to Arcadia Publishers, and they liked the idea. It's part of their American Palette series, which focuses on regional food. And so we felt very lucky that they took us on. And again, this one is much more historical, just a few recipes, about six. Some of the themes are the same: land, food, and culture. And it takes a historical look at that. So why are there so many roads in Montgomery County named for mills, you know, roads and communities? And why is the pattern of roads and land the way it is? And you realize a lot of it had to do with food and how the land was used. And so that theme kind of runs through both books. But in this one, we really took the opportunity to tell a lot of fun historic stories that go along with it.
Claudia did this great job putting together the Montgomery County timeline. So what has happened here on this ground?
Cool.
This county dirt.
Yeah.
Over a pretty long sweeping span. Mm-hmm. It starts with 1608 when Captain John Smith encounters the native Piscataway, the people who were living here.
Oh,
and all the way up to all the events, you know, through wars and depressions and canal and all kinds of different
Civil War,
both world wars, and traces population growth and all the sort of things and how, you know, there's sayings like what armies
travel on their stomachs.
I mean, all the things that come back to food.
Yeah.
And tradition and wisdom about how to grow and what to grow. And what not to grow, what works, what doesn't work. It's fascinating to me how we've, you know, what's old is new again, how we've come back to look at the practices of people who were here for, what, 10,000 years before the European settlement? The rapid changes that transpired after that and what that's wrought.
Yeah.
And how we're coming back to some practices that people before there were scientific way, you know, necessarily through observation, they understood what worked here, how to grow through, how to sustain things, how not to deplete that which sustains you. And so there are all these practices that we have a lot of chemistry that helps us understand that. People that understood that in a different way.
Right. I wanted to say something about like culinary history. I think a lot of times people dismiss it as, oh, ladies trading recipes or grandma's cookbook. Really, when you think about it, food, it reaches down into every single thing we do. It's an economy. Mm-hmm. It's the environment. It is culture. You can, and I'm going to put in a plug here for the Culinary Historians of Washington. They've been around for more than 20 years. People associated with the Smithsonian and writers and cooks and chefs, and they explore this in many different ways. And it's always amazing to me the topics that they come up with. But it's the same thing here. And the nice thing about culinary history is that it's not traditional great man history, because you're eating and that's something you do every day. It's helping your family survive. And so you hear from women and you hear from disenfranchised populations, people you don't usually hear from. And it gives you a really full picture of the community. And I was just so pleased when we were putting the book together and doing the index. It's like, yay, another woman. And, you know, it really is a way to tell, I think, a truer and more full story of history. history.
I love that observation, Claudia. That's so true.
Yeah.
And speaking of history, the history of the area, the land we're sitting on right now, was once owned by a step-granddaughter of George Washington.
Right.
Granddaughter of Martha Custis Washington. And her husband owned and ran the Seneca Quarry, which was just down at the river, just about a mile away. And the stone that was quarried from there was sent on flatboats down to Washington, D.C. to help build the Smithsonian Museum.
That's right.
On that note, I'm interested in how much the canal, the CNO canal yeah. in particular, comes up in this book, if at all.
Yeah, it gets a whole chapter because cool. in culinary history, they call it foodways, how you eat, create, yes. and serve food. It's foodways. And the canal has definite foodways, both in the houses, the lock houses,
yeah.
and on the boats.
And can you say really quickly, like, what the CNO Canal is and what lock houses
are? Oh, yeah,
are?
Sure. The CNO Canal runs from Georgetown out to Ohio, and it was a commercial project, and it was intended to bring raw materials from the West and ship out finished materials back out to Ohio. And frankly, it was never tremendously successful because it actually was in great competition with the B&O Railroad, which mm-hmm. broke ground on the same day as the canal.
No way, I didn't yeah. know that.
Yeah, it was kind of this weird omen.
Yeah.
But, you know, it really was a very particular place in the county. It was a transient population, people coming and going, a lot of workmen, like you said, down at the quarry and the boatmen. And so it's a very unique environment that I don't think you find in many places. So, of course, you know, like, for example, a regular boatman meal would be bean soup, and Ellen worked out that recipe for Bread and Beauty, and it's so delicious. It's so simple, but it's so delicious. But when you think about it, it makes perfect sense, right? You're on a boat, you have a bag of dried beans, you have some preserved meat, you have your water barrel, and so you've got the start of a soup. As you're going down the canal, you stop at a lock house where the owner, maybe his wife, runs a garden, and she can sell you a couple of tomatoes and an onion. And so, you know, you've got this soup bubbling away. You can attend to the boat. You can attend to your mules. You can pay attention to what's going on. And then you have dinner ready for yourself at the end of the day. And so, you know, that's a very particular meal that comes out of the local environment and the work that they're doing. So that's, you know, one of those examples. As soon as it opened, it became a tourist attraction. And we have this great picture of an ad in the book where you can take the packet boat out for the day and see the great construction. And oh. of course, you know, it wasn't the beautiful green leafy path that we know today.
Yeah.
It was a construction site, but it was interesting. And so sure. people came out. They came out to Great Falls Inn. They had a meal. They brought a picnic and then would go back out. So, you know, it was different, but in some ways the same, the way yeah. we use the canal.
For those listening who aren't local to this area, the canal today, if you're in Washington, it's the place to go, like, get in nature most immediately, I would say.
And then the Capitol Crescent Trail.
Yeah. What's funny, it used to be the railroad track. Now it's paved over, so it's a great bike path. It kind of runs parallel to it for a while. And the canal tow path itself, T-O-W, as in the mules would walk alongside towing the boat, that is still gravelly, so it's trickier to ride your bike. But, I mean, the marathons run through there. It's a great path. And it's also access to the water, so there's a ton of water stuff you can do on the river, of course. And so each of these... Now, these different lock houses act as these, like, boat entryways, you know, to the waterway. And so it really is still a very integral part of life, I would say, in this area, especially for those who like getting outside.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And every lock house stop is almost like a little mini park.
Yeah.
Or little destination. And the signposts along the way tell you which mile marker you're on. And there's all kinds of guides that tell you, you know, what to see at each mile marker. And there's some landmarks. I don't know the mile marker numbers, but up around the Monocacy Bridge, there's this gigantic tree. Have you seen that, Claudia or Ellen? Have you seen it?
It's a century tree, right?
I haven't seen it.
It's between Edwards Ferry and the Monocacy Bridge. We got to go see it. The canal is about 180 miles of scenic, green, lush, just beautiful, beautiful walking, riding your bike, no vehicles allowed. And it's parallel to the river, obviously, and then the towpath. And is right by the canal. And it's just a beautiful and national treasure, as they say.
Well, really, the point is, what's interesting is that it's kind of turned out to be a tourist destination, just as it was, like, from the beginning. I really like that observation.
Anybody here know what year it became, like, a national park? I mean, they were going to develop it, you know?
Yeah, it had a really interesting story. It was flooded in the 20s and really stopped as a commercial operation.
Do you mean
1920s?
1920s.
Okay. Then in the 30s, I think, it was turned over to the federal government. They kind of used it as a park. I think it was sort of informal. And then someone had the idea, you know, after the war, Washington was developing, roads and cars seemed to be the way to go. Someone had the idea, yeah, let's use that space because it's already cleared for a highway. You know, it would have run parallel to the George Washington Park on the Virginia side. And Justice William O. Douglas took advantage of his position and brought a Washington Post reporter with him and hiked the entire length of the canal all the way to Ohio. And of course, the reporter reported back, and you know, the birds and the tortoises and, you know, all kinds of things like that. And so it gave a new view of the canal. And that's really when, in the 60s, when it really said, yeah, this is a national park. It's not going to be a highway.
Yeah, I love that story, how this was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court,
right,
said, we have to save this. And he was very proactive.
Again, you know, a kind of political position,
you know,
using politics to make a point about land use.
And how is that related to how the Montgomery County Agriculture Reserve was established?
Well, I think because you had along the edge of the county this long linear park, plus there was a lot of open land out here, it seemed like the right place to put it. And even though, you know, it was in the 80s, the decision to do that was really about the environment, I think. And so they didn't really link together, but it was the sense that we can accommodate all of this. We can accommodate open land and farming and development in the county.
And now it's time for a listener voicemail.
Hi there. I am a mama who just listened to your back to school podcast, and I really appreciated it, and I've been meaning to call in, but I haven't yet, so I'm finally doing it. That podcast got it out of me, but it was just lovely. It kept on making me think about intentionality with parenting, and when we're talking about slow living, I think sometimes it gets missed in just the day-to-day relationships we have with our kids, and how sometimes we're so busy doing and trying to create these memories that we forget that our children just want to be with us. They just want to have that intentionality of a relationship with their parents or caretakers. And when it comes to the back to school things, I think that it is really important that we look at kind of how do we create those experiences that are going to create those memories versus making it just a consumerism thing and teaching them that, because I think that's what really matters to them and what I've seen as a parent and also a nanny many years. So yeah, I really appreciate that podcast and all you guys had to say. I'm over at Sparrow Stitchings on Instagram. I have a little mama run business trying to do sustainable stuff. So I really appreciate you guys, and I appreciated that podcast. All right, bye.
Thank you so much for calling in. We love hearing from you, and we welcome voicemails from anyone, anywhere, at any time. The mailbox number is 443-459-1950. You can find that number in our show notes, and we can't wait to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening and sharing and being a part of this community.
I want to ask each of you ladies, what is your own association and connection with the Ag Reserve? Ellen, you live here as well. What's your history in the area?
Well, I moved to the Ag Reserve, well, Boyds, Maryland, in a little town inside the reserve, from suburban Detroit. I reconnected with my college sweetheart, actually.
Aww.
It is a sweet story. And decided I was ready for a move. And I moved out here, and he was the only person I knew.
And did you know what it was before you moved here?
Not really. He just sort of said, well, I live on a farm. And I never lived on a farm. I didn't really exactly know how that worked. And I didn't really understand there could be a farm this proximate to, you know, our nation's capital. And I geographically, I just didn't have a sense of it when I moved here. And, you know, my concern was I have to recreate a personal life and a professional life and get incorporated into a family and into a community. And I got here and I just looked around. I didn't know what to make of where I was, really. Yeah. And so I think back that I came with a newcomer's perspective and curiosity and motivation to learn about my surroundings, because I needed to meet people and get engaged in something that was meaningful, you know, find a sense of purpose. And it turns out the Ag Reserve has provided all of that for me, and I had no idea. I was lucky enough to meet you guys through my association with the nonprofit that, you know, you've spoke at length about that works to protect the reserve. Mm-hmm. I worked early on for a woman who was running for a Montgomery County Council seat, and it was an at-large seat, which means she would represent people from the whole county, not just her district. But she happened to live up here, and she was trying to spread the word about the Ag Reserve to people who lived in other parts of the county and its importance. And so I did her meet and greets, and I ended up, again, you know, meeting all these people who didn't really know much about the place. And I was like, well, I knew why. I didn't know much about the place, but I didn't really understand how people who lived here couldn't appreciate it or didn't appreciate it.
Yeah. And just to give some context for those listening who aren't familiar with this area and the county and the way that the county is. So if you've heard of Washington, D.C., there's some very major little cities right out, or I guess I should say towns right outside the border where a lot of people that live and work in the city live. So a big one would be Bethesda, people might know, Silver Spring, Rockville, Maryland, Tacoma Park. So these are huge. If you know anything about D.C., you probably have heard of these towns. They're all in Montgomery County. So these big, I mean, they're really cities, are the same county as what we're talking about here, which between 20 and 30 miles kind of northwest, it's extensive farmland. So it's baffling to us, but if understanding the geography and the demography and what's happening, it is interesting. It's like people in Silver Spring might think, oh, I basically live in the city, but I also live in the same county where there is 100,000 acres of preserved farmland. So it's the
contrast, I guess we would say.
This is really interesting.
Isn't the Ag Reserve about one third of Montgomery County?
That's about one third of the landmass of the county. And it highly, as Emma was pointing out, the density of communities right outside of our nation's capital and the pressure to develop and provide housing and provide infrastructure and everything like that for this burgeoning population was one of the reasons that the reserve was put in place in the first place, because they were seeing the inevitability of farmland disappearing and the course of development and the transportation arteries that we were going to require, and said, well, we're going to do something quite radical, I think, right?
Yes.
As take a third of this incredibly dense and ever increasingly populous place and set it aside for farmland. I just think it's remarkable.
It is remarkable. It's almost miraculous when you stop and think about it.
Well, when we were first talking about Bread and Beauty, and we had some initial promotional events, and we met one of the architects of the reserve, came to the party, and he whispered to us, I didn't think it would last. Why would it, really? Because it basically was a zoning decision, right? So future people in charge of things like that could have undone it.
Yeah, it was zoning, and you're correct. I mean, you can always rezone. That happens regularly, but what further protects it, which you always point out, is people chose to put easements over the land as well. So as a private property owner, you put an easement on your land and you say, that's it. This land will never be developed. And so what you're doing is taking away value from the land. It's suddenly worth a lot less, but you're also lowering your taxes somewhat. And if you get enough people putting easements on the land, you can really cover a lot of ground. And so the reserve is a third of the county. 75% of that third is under easement. And so you have another layer of protection. And I think also by tradition, just the sense that this shouldn't change. And when you get enough people out here doing stuff, they become, even though they're not as many people out here, they have economic and political interests that they advocate for. So I think that helps also protect it. And I mean, I worked as a planner for the county for more than 20 years, and I wrote, you know, master plans. And I can't tell you how many times I wrote the sentence, the density comes down here to Bethesda and Silver mm-hmm. Spring and Tacoma Park, all the places you mentioned, so that the land and the ag reserve can stay open. And I think actually the strongest tool was the TDR. Transferable development rights. And so what that means is that one day you can build 5 houses on your land, and the next day, because it's been rezoned, you can only build 1 house. And that's legal, but you know, nobody's going to be happy about that. And you might end up in court. And so they came up with this tool called transferable development rights. And those 4 houses that you lost are an economic unit that you can sell. So a developer down in Bethesda wants to build a 4-story apartment building, but planners tell him, well, if you buy some TDRs from an upcounty farmer, we'll give you another floor. You can go to 5. Mm. And so they negotiate. There's a market price for these things. As there are fewer and fewer, their value goes up. So the farmer gets some cash for their land, for the lost value of those houses. They continue to farm and live on their property. And the development goes down to Bethesda and Silver Spring, where there are roads and libraries and parks and schools, where we've already made public investment in infrastructure. So let's use that. Let's get the value out of that. And I think that was probably a really strong tool to keep the reserve operating. You just can't develop on a lot of the land out here anymore.
What a brilliant idea. Was there a precedent for that somewhere, or did they come up with that?
Grand Central Station New York, the air rights. And so the notion of taking the value from one piece of land and transferring it to another is one that is actually pretty standard right now in planning.
Have you guys watched Gilded Age? It reminds me of that. It's kind of in that time when families were moving just sort of up and up Manhattan, and it was Central Park was really a forest. And it's just crazy to think that it's not that long ago that all of this was happening. I mean, no, 100 years ago, I would say 120, 150. How are we going to make room for these people? How are we going to develop? How do we want to live? And it's funny to think about how we're sort of doing that again now in a different way, and with the different technology and infrastructure that we have now. It's kind of a different question of how are we going to rein all this in? How can we use our creative power and our communal power and our interest to make decisions?
I think one of those big questions we're asking now is how are we going to feed ourselves? Which circles us all the way back around to the ag reserve and the book. It's the common denominator. One of a very few common denominators of all humans is that we have to eat. And as we've been saying, we've kind of lost our sense of place in what we're eating. And all of this is a way of kind of bringing it back because of necessity. So want to launch more into that, like, you know, stories and recipes from the book. But did you have anything more to say about your connection with the Ag Reserve before we move on?
Well, I think working as a planner and writing that sentence over and over again, and we lived down in Glen Echo, kind of on the edge of it. And, you know, we would come out here regularly, pick pumpkins and apples and ride bikes on the canal. So I kind of thought I knew it. Mm-hmm. But really, when Ellen and I started this book, I realized, oh my God, I was just scratching the surface. What energy and creativity people bring to life out here. Mm-hmm. The farming, the nature groups, the history groups. It's very, very rich and deep.
And what's interesting about the lesser development than other parts of this area is how much closer you are to these stories and the history. So there's a lot of things that are really untouched. And what I love about this area, and we've talked about it on a few episodes on this podcast a lot with Tony Cohen, our friend, just the history of the freed slave community and the Civil War and everything that was going on around that. I mean, there are slave graves that you can just find in the woods here that are fascinating, and buildings that have just been untouched, and growing up in places that were very developed and then living in the city for a while, unless you're like really downtown by like super historical places. You just don't come in contact with that history so easily.
I think Montgomery County is really lucky to have really engaged and professional historical societies. We were so reliant on the Montgomery History, which records county history, and the Sandy Spring Archives, which was the Quaker community up in the eastern side of the county. And again, you know, you think it's not like downtown Washington where you have all these historic buildings and everybody knows what went on there and you see the pictures. Yeah, it's just some woods, right? Yeah. What's out here? Oh, there's a lot. And these groups in the county are so good at preserving it.
Yeah. I want to remark on a phenomenon I've noticed ever since I've lived here, which has been 10 years now. Not a lot of people know about it. And this is both amazing and disturbing to me in a way, which is one of the really great gifts of your two books now, is just letting people know that it's here. Let's transition into tell more about, you know, recipes and stories. And
what are some of your favorite stories from the book? Like from this particular, we keep harkening back to Bread and Beauty too, but like this project, what was like a new thing you learned or one of your favorite things?
Well, one of the stories that has really captivated my imagination and know very little about is the people who were here originally before first contact, before, you know, Europeans settlers came here, and how they lived. And Claudia pointed out how sophisticated their food culture was and what they knew about growing food, and like the three sisters, you know, corn, beans, and squash, how they interrelate, and about nitrogen fixing and all these sort of things that they must have known through observation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that we've now come
Imagine,
much later on.
They figure that out by watching it.
Yes.
And doing it.
Trial and error. And seasonal cooking and seasonal planting and rotation and, you know, not depleting your soil, which was a story that just keeps being revisited and revisited and revisited through tobacco plantations and, you know, rotational grazing and monocultures and all the things we talk about today about, you know, the environmental impacts and what works sustainably for growing food and other things. So what they knew, and that they ate extremely well. I have a quote here from the book, page 38. Waverly Root in the book Eating in America points out that we often view Native American cooking as a survivalist effort, a poor collection of acorns and insects. The white man has always liked to believe that the Indian dwelt in a state of perpetual misery until Europeans arrived to improve his condition.
Yes.
He speculates at the time of contact, indigenous people were eating better than the average European, with a wider variety and more equitable distribution of food, cooked with considerable finesse and served following codes of politeness and equity. It was a rich and varied and healthy diet, and that the Europeans came and probably would have floundered and not done so well.
Oh, definitely.
You know, using their own resources they had hoped to import to a place that it's different.
They were trying to bring stuff over on the boat.
Yeah. They must not have food over there. Let's bring them cans or whatever. I don't know.
There's another quote. While some native foods were found across regions, foodways were based in local environments that naturally created regional variety. And as Root wrote, there's as much difference between an Algonquin and a Hopi as between a Swede and an Italian.
Oh, that's amazing.
I love this. This is right. You know, and then about foraging and hunting and all the things that, you know, we've talked about, the rich diversity of plants and fish. Even there were plentiful trout.
Oh, I mean,
do we think about this area as being plentiful in trout? And sumac for cooking.
As a spice. I mean, when you think about it, you know, European settlers came over and, you know, the land that it wasn't theirs back in Europe, you would be accused of poaching because it belonged to a lord or a king or something. You know, here the land was open. And so, of course, the Indians had plenty of food and they responded seasonally. When the fish ran, they would fish and smoke it and trade with other tribes. And so there was a lot more access to a lot more varied food. And I think it was Powhatan, when the white men came, he didn't think they were a big threat because they didn't know how to plant corn.
Yeah, they were dum-dums.
So he's like, oh, these people are not going to last. I think that's very telling as far as, you know, what your capabilities are.
That's so interesting what you bring up about the land ownership, because the native people here, they didn't have that capitalist system of land ownership and acquiring their daily needs through commerce. Again, they just knew how to get it straight from the source.
I mean, there were definitely tribes and territories, you know, but the sense of ownership. And I think actually, and we're always talking about these stories that reverberate through history, the sense of stewardship, because, you know, you do it this year and next year, you do it properly and the fish will come again and again. And the hunting season, you know, will be the same. European settlers came here thinking about extraction. Mm-hmm. Where's the gold? Where is the metal? Tobacco was a market crop. You can't eat tobacco, but you could sell it. And so there was that different sense of what you want out of the land. And that is the same today. Well, you know, are you going to develop it or are you going to steward it and use it for something that might not be?
Just a general short-term gratification versus this understanding of this long-term sustainability, really. It's weird, but the first thing that popped in my head when you said that was cryptocurrency. You know, kind of the new frontier of the economy, whatever. Everyone wants in on it. Gold rush. No one's thinking about long term. It's like, how does this work?
Well, the land use thing is what's so interesting, and how we talk about how the Europeans came to this continent and it was about what the land could give them in the short term. The gold, the
tobacco.
Yeah, the gold, tobacco, furs, you know, in the short term and profit from.
And also, what could they put stakes around and say, this is mine, I'm a lord now, or whatever.
Right, that's, you know, right. So how is that carried through today and the challenges we're facing with the agricultural reserve? It's the same kind of mentality. How can we use this land to take care of the problems? You know, we need more townhouses, we need more shopping centers for these people out here. It's the same kind of conflict again. Hopefully, the preservation of this place helps people have more of a broader vision and a longer term vision of what the land has to offer other than those things.
Well, not even what the land has to offer, but our own dependence on the land and the longevity of the land.
Right. And what the land offers, the gift of the land, is pollination.
Yeah, yeah.
Clean air, biological diversity, which we're learning
food
is
food on our table.
Yeah. The diversity question science is helping us understand more and more is really, really huge.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, why do a book? Really? Why do the first book, which was a big lift for us? I mean, I didn't, you know, we self-published it, and I, in particular, hadn't done a project like that before. I had no idea what was involved, and it was very involved. But we were driven by the hope to tell these stories. We thought it was important to both of us, and we thought, you know, people would be interested and curious, and that takes so long to find out what goes on in a place. I mean, you know, we know it took 5 years of research and putting together stories and then trying to get them in some sort of form that you can pass them along to other people. Mm-hmm. So it's quite an endeavor. And then, you know, we talk about some people who don't know about this place and farmland preservation and stuff like that. You know, it takes a concerted effort to do so. So I think why write a book is to tell stories and have it live on in a way, like the book's now in the library, even though we don't have any more Bread and Beauties to sell. The book, it lives on as a storytelling vehicle. And then why tell history stories in particular, or historical stories? Is it hopefully there's something to be learned? I mean, it's fascinating. I think it's really, really interesting. Yeah. What I didn't know, what I didn't know about this place, and the links between transportation and land use and moving food from market to market, you know, and how do you keep things cold? I mean, Claudia tells us the great story about the...
Oh, the little refrigerator.
The little refrigerator.
Tell that story.
The Quaker community in Sandy Spring, Ashton, I think it was Thomas Moore, and he wanted to get his butter down to the market in downtown D.C., down Georgia Avenue, and it would melt by the time he got there. So he invented what he called a refrigeratory, and it was an oval kind of cedar box, and then within that he set a tin box, and around it packed ice, and then wrapped it in wool and rabbit's fur to pelts to insulate it. And he found that it worked, and he could get his butter to market, and even have like a little chip of ice to give the person who bought it so they could get it home. And this was kind of a breakthrough. It sounds like nothing. And he invited Thomas Jefferson to take a look at this thing. And, you know, Thomas Jefferson was very interested in food and gardening. And so the only record we have of it is the sketch that Jefferson drew on the letter that Moore sent him, because the patent office had a fire and Moore's patent was one that was lost. So we just have this little sketch in the corner of the invitation. And evidently, Jefferson bought one because later in a letter, his granddaughter complains bitterly about how the thing didn't work and it wasted the only ice they had. But, you know, that kind of technology, which is what it is yeah. another echo through history.
Wow.
How we get food to market, the tools that we use. And there's quite a few of those in here. There's one that I think is really interesting. You know, the Glen Echo area, which mm-hmm. used to be an amusement park. It was originally a Chautauqua. It was developed because someone named Edwin Baltzly invented a culinary beater, like basically an egg beater, and made a lot of money. And so he and his brother decided, let's take the money and develop land with it. And so they developed Glen Echo. And now, of course, it's a landmark and it itself has a fascinating history. But again, here's how food influences
wow.
where you live and what you look like. So if you've ever, we used to live right near Glen Echo. And, you know, it's a very unique and charming community. And you're like, why is it like this? Well,
yeah.
Because of an
egg
beater.
That's amazing.
I love that. That's so funny.
And you said before the Glen Echo theme park was built, it was Chautauqua land?
Yes, it was a Chautauqua. And Chautauquas were like these kind of like a betterment society. The original one was in New York, but you would go there and rent one of the little cottages and there would be musical performances and plays and uplifting speeches, religious or scientific or political. And it was sort of this summer retreat.
Like a family summer camp.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like in the movie Dirty Dancing, if you've seen it.
Kind of. But, you know, it was really kind of meant for edification. You know,
yeah.
you would go and listen to opera and things like that. And so, of course, there was a cafe there. I think it was called the Potomac Cafe. I haven't come across the menu of what they served. But it eventually, Chautauqua's kind of lost their energy. People had other options, I guess, for travel and vacation. And so it turned into the Glen Echo Amusement Park, which was connected to D.C. via a trolley line. So people would come and, you know, you could swim in the Crystal Pool and ride the Ferris wheel and the roller coaster. And we have a picture in the book of during World War II of people coming out like soldiers and sailors, you know, to meet people and mm-hmm. socialize mm-hmm. and, you know, eat fair food. And also eventually the amusement park kind of lost its attraction for people. Now it's part of the national park that runs along the canal too, and we're trying to figure out exactly. Now it's like, I think a lot of artists are there, but
yeah.
they're always kind of working on a plan for what should happen there.
Before COVID hit, there would still be weekly activities out there.
Oh, yeah.
I had been to the contra dancing thing
yeah.
that they used to have every Friday night out there. And then there was a ballroom dancing thing. And did they still do that?
The ballroom is still there. And so, but I don't know if the dancing has come back.
These weekly classes. And there was like this community that the same people would come
yeah.
all the time. I only went once or twice, but it was so much fun.
Yeah.
A really important part of the Glen Echo story too is that it was segregated for
yes.
a long time. Up,
yes.
And it's referenced in MLK's letter from Birmingham
oh,
jail.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. He says, I have a dream that one day my kids can go to the same amusement parks as their
oh.
friends. It's
yes, there
the
was
Glen
a
Echo
big
park.
Protest there during that time, and it did integrate. They
mm-hmm.
did allow
yes.
people to come, but, you know, shortly thereafter, it just wasn't, you know, people
yeah.
had more money. They can go to Disney World, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Another of the many favorite stories is about the Montgomery County Farm Women's Cooperative Market.
Yeah.
It started
yeah.
in the 1930s. Well, there was this group of women who, of course, ran farms out here mostly, and, you know, they had dairy operations, and so they, you know, very diverse operations, and they was this post or coming out of the Depression, and people were threatened with losing their land and their property and needed to put food on the table and pay their mortgages and everything else, and they got together through working with the Extension Service and put a market together against pretty fierce opposition,
oh,
we
yeah.
learned, by
yeah.
the community. And
why was that?
It was in Bethesda. And it was kind of a ritzy neighborhood. And I don't think people wanted like tent market next to their homes. So it was kind of scotch. You know, they persisted and built their own market hall. And so, yet they persisted.
Yet they persisted. And they ended up being able to
yeah.
pay mortgages. And
is it that same building that's still there?
Yep.
Wow.
And yeah. send children to college and get shoes for the kids and buy a car for the household. And
wow.
And yeah. they were very community oriented. I mean, they yeah. were trying to help lift up and bring up and bring along everybody into this endeavor that they had put together, and knew a neighboring farm was in trouble. And then the farmer said, oh, I don't have anything to bring to market that's valuable. And they said, well, do you have cow manure? You know, you have firewood. I'm trying to think of the other thing.
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, we have that. Plentiful. Bring it to the market and all sold.
Wow.
All yeah, sold. Everything that they brought
For their gardens
was very valued. And and we're talking about density, you know, and yeah. people have the land to grow food, to keep cattle and
yeah.
produce things that are very desirable and necessary for people who don't have the land or the ability or the time or the know-how to do that, and that cooperative community that is created by yes. having both exist proximate to each other.
I think that's true. I mean, you know, someone in Sandy Spring wrote that the city and country continue to enrich each other because the city provides the market and the country provides the product. And of course, so much more in both cases. And we are very lucky to have them in proximity. And I think, you know, we need to recognize that and preserve it and enhance it.
Yes.
You would think, oh, Montgomery County, like it's just this special little place. But really, a lot of the stories in the book echo things that are happening around the world. And one of them is Marriott and the hot shops. And people who have been around D.C. remember the hot shops. It started actually as a little root beer stand down in D.C., but Bill Marriott was very attuned to the market, and he saw that the communities were suburbanizing and they were coming out into Montgomery County, and so he watched like certain intersections, how many cars were driving by, and he would put a hot shop at these intersections, and it was a coffee shop where you could get the hamburger that's on the cover of the book, the Mighty Moe, and it became popular with families, with working people, with high school kids who would hang out. It just became this very particular to DC thing. And of course, he again was watching the market, and I think he was driving someone to National Airport one day, and they're like, stop, I want to get a sandwich because there's no food once I get on the plane. And he was like, light bulb. And so he started supplying airports and airlines, and then extended to government cafeterias and catering there. And of course, as we all know, Marriott is now an international hospitality chain. And so that move from local, getting your dairy from up the road, getting the butter from the farm down Georgia Avenue to an international food chain, it's really what's happened around the world. Mm. It's just what we expect now. We expect the shelves to be full, like you were saying. And so it's really very reflective. What happened in Montgomery County is very reflective of the way food works today.
That's an awesome story.
Great story.
I didn't know about this, Mighty. Are there any left of the hot shop?
No. They closed. I think the last one closed in the 80s. It was the one at the corner of East West Highway in Wisconsin. But tons of people remember it. You scratch, you know, any older person. They were gone by the time I came, but people love it.
And he was from D.C. or?
Well, he was from Utah because, you know, he was part of the Mormon community. But I think he came through Washington and saw how hot it was and thought a root beer stand. He's a very entrepreneurial person. And he and his wife pursued opening it. And for a while they did Mexican food. And his wife went down to the Mexican embassy and got some recipes. But, you know, they were always tinkering and always adjusting.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing, too, it wasn't just like a guy making a hamburger. He had a whole system. You know, they were regular recipes that you had to follow. You serve it on this plate. You wrap it in this paper.
Right. That and sort so of that, franchise model.
Exactly. Yeah. Turning it into an industrial product.
Yeah.
Which, you know, feeds a lot of people, but it definitely removes you from how the food is produced.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So interesting. Ellen, any more book stories?
I would ask Claudia actually to another one that isn't kind of a parochial story, you know, has wider interest and implications, is Josiah Henson.
There are wonderful books about him, that one that has just been written that is so good. He's a story in himself, an extraordinary person, and he was enslaved, clearly an intelligent and alert, and he was way smarter than the man who claimed to own him. And he often used food. He described the meal, the slave's meal, and it sounds meager, but okay, you know, what do you expect? But when you look at it in a larger context of where they were living and how they were treated and what their lives were like, it's really very grim. But he used food to serve his community and also as sort of a tool of power. His owner's nephew, I think, was always hungry. They didn't feed this kid enough. Mm. So he would go to Josiah, and Josiah would feed him. And many years later, when he was trying to become free and do it like the right way with his papers and everything, his owner was cheating him, and this nephew stood up for him and said, you know, because Josiah had treated him open-heartedly and open-handedly. Yeah. And, you know, he was always very alert to the needs of his community. And, you know, they would steal a chicken or take a pig out into the woods and slaughter it because he saw their suffering and knew that food was not only the physical sustenance that they had, but the sustenance of community.
And spirit.
So, yeah. Yes, and spirit. And so he was able to create that. He's an extraordinary man, really.
So his role in the book is how he used food in his enslaved community.
Yeah.
So he was like a community leader and chef and wow.
Well, he wasn't a chef, but he managed the farm for Isaac Riley, who.
And where in the county was that?
Actually, that is a great resource right now. It's over, I don't know exactly how to describe it. It's not in the city of Rockville, but it's like Rockville, Pike, and Old Georgetown Road.
Yeah.
There's the Josiah Henson Museum now.
Oh, cool.
Beautiful building. Gorgeous building, excellent exhibits inside, and what the County Parks Department is doing, this land had all been built over suburbanite, you know, with suburban homes. They have great plans to, they've already bought a couple of the houses, and when those people who live in them pass on, they will revert to the county, and the county will be able to do a lot of borings and figure out how this plantation, the extent of the plantation, and how it actually worked.
So sort of rebuild it.
Yeah, and create a larger environment around the house. And the house that remains was the kitchen, which, you know, is often separate from the main house because of fire and heat issues. And so that was the original. They call it Uncle Tom's Cabin, but he likely never lived in it, but it was where he lived. And the kitchen was in that same location, likely. So, you know, again, it's like we were talking about before, you know, when you pursue food and when you pursue other stories, you get a much wider and more interesting picture of history and the place you live.
Well, because it's so much more personal and
connected
to the person instead of just a story of what happened around that person. And also, it's something that we do too. We still eat. So that's a way to really connect with those people.
I think that's really true. Yeah.
Okay. So, Ellen, what does the good dirt mean to you? You can answer that any way you want.
Well, what I've been thinking about, having listened to your podcast before and knowing that this might be a likely question and it's such a good one, and all the different ways that people have answered it and who know a lot more about soil health and things like that than I do. So what came to me was thinking about the tradition of storytelling and the sharing and passing down of knowledge, wisdom, culture, practices, building of community, telling stories. Like so many people engaged in farming do here, you know, they help each other and they pass along the accumulated knowledge, you know, through the years. Mm-hmm. There's so many ways to approach this, right? And that keeps the good dirt good. I mean, useful and fertile. And I think about the, you know, the good part, there's certainly no shortage of difficulties, you know, worldwide. And we hear about those stories and they're tragic and devastating and difficult to know how you fit in to the solutions. And I think the good dirt represents a positive way for us to band together, share our thoughts and proposals. And you guys talk about paradigm shifts and things like that. that when we're engaging these conversations and more people are engaging in these conversations, there's the hope and the promise of some good coming out of that and solutions and maybe ways to shift and disrupt and make things better for everyone. So I like that idea of just sharing, you know, the good dirt and building these relationships, just like we build soil health, and it's a complex and, takes the long view and takes time. Mm-hmm. And investment in the same way that investing time in talking to each other about these sorts of things. So I guess that's what comes to mind.
Oh, I
thank
love
you.
That.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
Claudia, what does the good dirt mean to you?
I think of the good dirt as kind of a canvas. Going back to what I said before, this land looks empty. And I think of it as a canvas where people bring their energy, their ideas, and making the connections that Ellen was talking about, and create something. And this space allows them to do that. And I think we need that space, whether it's in the city, you know, kind of this open area, or whether it's out here, we need space to pursue these ideas and create something that's good for ourselves as individuals, but also for the larger community.
Thank you. And quickly, what does slow living mean to you, Claudia?
I always think of seasonal eating. Mm-hmm. I love my CSA, and I look forward every year to, you know, that shift in season when suddenly strawberries appear, or frankly, you know, the root vegetables and the forced creativity that I have to bring to the kitchen. And just the joy of seeing all the different colors and textures and flavors. That's where I get slow.
Yeah. What about you, Ellen? What does slow living mean to you?
Noticing how I live and making more intentional choices. And I think the more I notice, the more I need to slow down. I mean, from anything that I consume or how I spend my time, it's pretty much everything. I mean, it's quite a kind of ripping the cover off of habit and, you know, culture and how I engage in all that sort of stuff. So that has really slowed me down. Like Claudia, I've been a member of a CSA. That's a completely different way for me to live and eat.
100%.
Yeah. And take care of things and appreciate what goes into farming, and to know that I would starve if left to my own devices, because I'm not good at that. I mean, there's so much to learn and know. I would starve learning and know, you know, trying to figure it out. And so I'm so grateful for that opportunity. And when I think, oh no, I have to once a week spend all this time in air quotes going and getting this food and then processing it all because it's fresh, right? So if I don't take good care of it and not waste it, you know, I have to, there's some work involved in that. And then I'm also wearing the product of being a lady farmer enthusiast, because I learned about Alabama Channon and sustainable clothing. And I took this old ratty t-shirt that I loved, and I cut out scraps from another thing, and I mended my own clothing.
How cute is
and
that?
This is an old linen bathrobe that I've just made into this little
jacket.
And
so,
so
cute.
It's really, and that's time consuming.
I'm wearing my lady farmer scarf.
Yay!
Oh my God. Which I love.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Now I have to learn how to sew. You
yeah.
know?
Oh, I wish
we had some time.
As always, this was great.
Yeah. We like to usually ask at the end if there's anything in particular that you would like the listeners to understand about the work that you guys have done, or that you continue to do, or the book in particular, just sort of anything you want to leave them with.
Well, I want you to buy the book.
Yeah.
You can find it online at Arcadia Publishing. But also, I think you should look around your own community and see who's been there before you. And, you know, maybe it was just 10 years ago, maybe it was 10,000 years ago. But it's interesting. It'll add interest and depth and meaning to your life. So look at your own community.
Yeah. And how would you suggest someone?
Oh, local historical societies, local farmers, nature groups. There are all kinds of, there's a lot of people out there doing interesting things that you can help with and get involved.
There's a reservoir that's a backup drinking water supply for 4 million people in this area. So it's a very important, but it's also a place for recreation and sojourn and, you know, getting in touch with nature. And during the pandemic, a lot of people were really searching for things to do with their kids and being outdoors and being socially distanced. So that was a very busy place. And I think that that was another access point for people to see that what's available right in their own quote unquote backyards, you know, to get more in touch with nature and natural systems and being outdoors and all the wonderful things. And they drew people to their open spaces.
Yeah.
And I hope that continues. You know, I just hope that that was so invigorating and soul satisfying that, that something's shifted.
Thanks again for coming, ladies. It was fun to see you guys. Fun to be out here at the farm just chatting. And we'll be in touch.
It was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Good Dirt Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, we hope you'll share it with a friend to spread the good dirt.
This show is produced by Lady Farmer, a slow living lifestyle community, and the original music is composed and performed by John Kingsley.
For more from Lady Farmer, follow us on Instagram at @WeAreLadyFarmer. That's @WeAreLadyFarmer. Or join us online at www.ladyfarmer.com. We'll see you next time on the Good Dirt.
Goodbye.